Hello and welcome to The Scoop, a provincial newscast and podcast with stories from LJI journalists around British Columbia. Each week, reporters from Revelstoke, Cortes Island, Kootenay, Terrace, Prince George, and Smithers will share the news affecting their place in BC. I'm your host and producer, Pamela Hassan, from CSCK News in Smithers. The Scoop was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program, or LJI. Follow The Scoop on CICK, Smithers Community Radio, 93.9 FM, every Thursday and Saturday at noon, online at smithersradio.com, and of course, wherever you get your podcasts. In Smithers, the BC Wildlife Federation, BCWF, made a stop in Smithers to meet with potential voters and their membership to discuss the group's priorities for the upcoming election and what changes they would like to see around habitat protection and better management of wildlife populations and ensure hunting and fishing rights are protected as well. The Cortes Housing Society, CHS, has applied for BC Housing's community housing funds three times over the past 6 years and was recently denied again. The Kitimat Museum and Archives held the first ever all-high slaw community art show for the Kitimat Museum, and a small tourist accommodation received mixed feedback during a recent public hearing on May 2nd in Revelstoke, and the results for the regional district of Central Kootenay. RDCK May 11 referendum brought mixed results for curbside collection in Kootenay.
A proposal to amend two zoning bylaws for a property on Airport Way in rural Revelstoke to allow for the development of a small tourist accommodation received mixed feedback during a recent public hearing. While some were supportive of the bylaw amendments, others said they were concerned about increased traffic volume and potential erasure of the current rural lifestyle if the amendments are approved. The public hearing took place on May 2nd at the Revelstoke Community Center and was chaired by Columbia Shuswap Regional District Area B Director David Brooks Hill. The meeting drew a small crowd of just 18 people attending both in person and online. The owner of the property, located at 4762 Airport Way, has been operating as a vacation rental since 2018 under a temporary use permit issued by the CSRD. The current permit is set to expire this month. If approved, the amended bylaws would allow for the development of four tourist cabins along with a six-bedroom lodge and a dwelling unit for the owner-operator. The proposed development also includes plans for off-street parking and additional on-site utilities. The development would take place in two phases. For this to happen, the property owner is seeking to change the official community plan designation for the property from small holdings to resort commercial and to rezone the property from small holdings to resort commercial too. Christine LaFlock, with the CSRD Planning Department, said the 7.5-hectare property could create the potential for up to 40 tourist cabins and a lodge with up to 15 sleeping units, but that scale of development does not fit with the surrounding neighborhood or the official community plan. A special regulation is being proposed to limit the scale of the development to what is being presented at this time. LaFlock said the property owner is agreeable to this. Following the presentation, members of the public were invited to provide feedback on the proposed rezoning and tourist accommodation. Members of the public who spoke during the meeting were asked to provide their full name and address. The property owner spoke several times during the meeting, but did not provide his name. He was referred to as Kelly by others speaking at the meeting. Following the meeting, Stoke FM reached out to CSRD staff for the property owner's full name, but were told a name could not be provided due to Freedom of Information legislation. Staff had further reached out to the property owner and were told that the owner did not want his name included in this report. Journalistic standards do not allow for anonymity except for in rare and exceptional circumstances, which does not typically include the name of a property owner speaking at a public meeting. A report of the public hearing will be provided to CSRD Board of Directors, who will then consider giving the proposed bylaw amendments a third reading. For 92.5 Stoke FM in Revelstoke, I'm Melissa Jamieson.
You are tuned to CICK News on 93.9 FM in Smithers. CICK News is your news source for regional and provincial news Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m., 2 p.m., and 4 p.m. It's hosted by Dan Messick and myself, Pamela Hassan. Find and follow CICK News online at smithersradio.com and frequencynews.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. CICK News is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada.
Today on, with only 6 months left before the next provincial election, parties, candidates, and advocacy groups are gearing up for what could be one of the hottest political contests this province has seen in years. This weekend, the BC Wildlife Federation made a stop in Smithers to meet with voters and discuss the BCWF priorities for the upcoming election and what changes they want to see around habitat protection and better management of wildlife populations, as well as ensuring hunting and fishing rights are protected as well. David Lewis, president of the BC Wildlife Federation, and Steve Hamilton spoke with a small group of voters at the Bulkley Valley Rod and Gun Club. I caught up with them following the event. Stay with us.
Steve Hamilton, BC Wildlife Federation, Conservation, Hunting, Angling, Firearms Policy and Engagement Coordinator.
It's a mouthful.
David Lewis, BC Wildlife Federation President.
Steve, maybe you can just give me a rundown of what are you guys doing here tonight? I know you have a bunch of these going on around the province. So tell me a little bit about this evening and what you're trying to present to people.
Basically, it's time for the province and government to put wildlife first in British Columbia. David and I are traveling across Region 6 here, the Stikine and Skeena, and we're visiting a bunch of clubs and with the intent of teaching and educating people who show up the shortfalls of wildlife management in British Columbia.
Some of what you outlined there was that there's an election coming up. A lot of these were focused on policy issues and mismanagement. Tell me a little bit about more of the positions of the BC Wildlife Federation on some of those issues you laid out.
Yeah, the BC Wildlife Federation, first of all, is a nonprofit charity. We're not partisan in our approach. We're factual, and this has been a failure of successive governments for going well over 50 years. It's time for them, as I said, to put wildlife first, and we're demanding for the next government to give us a few different things in legislation, for everything from funding models to legislated objectives to public access for public resources, and a various bunch of other things.
I'm going to get to you in a sec, Dave. I just do it one at a time. I guess the other thing is you're doing a few of these across the region. What are you hearing from people? Tonight, we didn't see a huge turnout here in Smithers, but we obviously know that Smithers in the Bulkley Valley has a pretty deep history in hunting and angling, and we know there's hunters and anglers around. What do you think is holding up people, and what are you hearing from them out on doing these tours?
I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of apathy in the hunting and angling and shooting community. People, for the longest time, haven't felt that their voice matters. But what we're trying to do is show them why it should matter and why it does matter. We have a bunch of successes over the last few years of people getting up, getting loud, and making their voices heard, and causing government to back off on some policies. We just saw it with the Land Act by people getting loud and getting engaged.
One of the long-standing issues that you mentioned was the money, the funds that are taken from our licenses and where that money goes. And we know that it's long-standing that a lot of it just goes to general revenue. What are some of the key points that you laid out wanting to improve some of this to see more funds going into management and co-management of some of these resources?
We want to see better allocation of resources. We know our wildlife biologists are working hard. They're not funded properly. Same goes for our natural resource officers, our conservation officers. When they are underfunded and lacking in their ability to do their job, wildlife and habitat is going to suffer. And we've seen it for well over 50 years, as we talked about in the presentation.
One thing that I found really interesting there, you mentioned some of the numbers, the allocations. Like, we're not even hitting the percentages of the allocation every year. It's way below. Where's your kind of take and the Wildlife Federation's take and stance on that front? What improvements would you like to see, and how are you going about engaging the government on that?
We're continuing to tell the government, as I said, to put wildlife first, to put science at the forefront of their decision making. If you're not funding science properly, your decision-making and the policies you're putting out are going to suffer. As I said, we've seen that for over 50 years, so that's what the Federation is advocating for. We're advocating for better funding, legislated objectives, and everything will start to fall into place over the years if that starts to happen.
Just the last thing for you, between now and election coming up in October, what's the game plan? What are you hoping to do to engage voters and anglers and hunters over the next few months?
It's not just about hunting, angling, and sports shooting. It's about everybody that cares about wildlife and habitat. It's from consumptive users to non-consumptive users throughout the province. Myself and David and other members of the Federation are stopping in every single management unit across the province, all the way from Vancouver Island, all the way up into Fort St. John area, and everywhere in between. We're hoping to see as many hunters, anglers, sports shooters, and those that care about wildlife out in these venues that are hosted by our member clubs that we're so grateful for. They do incredible work on the ground on our behalf. And we just need to see more people out that want to engage, learn how to put wildlife first this October.
And I guess from your perspective, this evening a lot of information, a lot of data was laid out. Where do you see this going? It sounds like you've tried to engage a number of the MLAs in the area, in your riding, and it sounds like it's a bit of a conflictual relationship now because you are trying to push against a lot of the policies that they haven't really moved upon. So where do you sit in all this? Where does the BC Wildlife Federation see this going in an election year?
Part of it's educating the public. Whether the consumptive user is easy, they know what the problem is. The non-consumptive user, the wildlife viewers, everybody out there, the way this government and the past governments have managed with these cuts, they're managing to zero. So it's not going to matter if you're First Nations, it's me, it's Steve, it's yourself, it's whoever. There will be nothing left on the landscape. If they don't change the way that they're practicing, they're managing, they're mismanaging this environment, there is nothing left for anybody. They need to change these policies. They need to put the funding in place. They need to put the proper resources. They need to take the political influence out of these decisions, and things have to be science-based. It can't be bureaucratical influence that's making these decisions.
It seems like that's a constant, not only in this respect, but in fisheries, in forestry, in mining. All of these issues seem to have had some level of mismanagement. And not only in this government, in previous governments as well, because I know you guys were pushing on the previous government for a lot of changes as well. Going forward in the next few months, as we get closer to the election, what's your plan to get out and get that education piece? One of the pieces you mentioned there, a big part of it, the funding and the co-management. We need management to be done outside of government is what you pointed out there. Can you explain that a little bit more? Where would you like to see some of that funding going?
When you look at people like the Freshwater Fishery Society, where you remove a lot of the decision-making and the work that's being done outside of government, you remove the interference, you remove the political decisions, you remove who makes the biggest donation gets those decisions made for them. It's time that we actually looked at what wildlife is. How do we save our wildlife? Do we want to see steelhead in this river gone? We've watched the decline from an abundant population to now we're in extreme conservation issues. We're watching our salmon disappear. If we don't start seeing some changes in our policies, predator management, when you do predator management recoveries, it doesn't matter if it's pinnipeds, it's wolves, it's bears, there has to be a balance. And if we don't start managing the way we need to mount, what science tells us, nobody's using the resource. Whether it's federally with fisheries, it's provincially with fisheries. You watch the provincial and federal government with fisheries banging their head against the wall saying the other guy's going to look after it, the other guy's going to look after it. In the meantime, nobody's out here looking after it. We're losing habitat. We lose critical habitat. And you mentioned resource extraction. Resource extraction, we need the jobs, but there's a fine line with the balancing act. You have to make everything work together. You can't, putting a forester in charge of animals has never worked in this province. It has never worked. We've watched the decline of everything. You want to remove every tree right down from the water's edge to the top of the mountain, nothing grows. There's nothing. If you don't put broadleaf trees back in there, you don't change the practices, you stop spraying glyphosates, you've got to make some serious changes. They have to put the environment, they have to put the animals, and they need to find that balancing act to make things work in this province.
Just the last thing for you, or a couple of things maybe. A lot of what you're talking about is would fall in the umbrella of conservation. Conserving a lot of what you just mentioned there. You also showed a clip of or a slide of all the conservation groups that you guys have partnered with or work with. Obviously, you also have some conflict there because they work on other things like you're talking about the Rancos buying up a lot of the hunting grounds on the coast there, but you also work together. Where do you find the balance? Who do you partner with to push the government in this direction that you're talking about?
The coalition has put aside its views to be in that room. Everything comes off the table. You take your hat off, you leave it at the door, you're there to discuss wildlife. It's not, I want to hunt, I want to save every last tree. It's about working together for the betterment of wildlife. And everybody needs to work together, whether it's First Nations, consumptive and non-consumptive users, bear viewers, everybody has to work together. If we don't work together, we have nothing. And the government loves to conquer and divide. So if they can separate us, they win. If we stand together, we win. And with these coming elections, people have to take a look at what matters. Standing together, coming in united, and looking at what is actually out there. at some point they're going to have to put their policies on the table for us to question. We have not seen a policy yet. That's why we had the slide up that said, here's the asks, what the government's policies will be going into this election. It's all question marks because there's nothing. They've put nothing on the table. We don't even know who the candidates are out here yet. Most of those candidates aren't announced. We can't even question on what they're going to do. We speak with party leaders. They don't have any answers for us right now. And we've met with several of the parties at this point, and we've put these demands on them. We've done this presentation for two out of the three parties in the province because one party has not met with us yet. And we're putting the same thing that you're seeing in the town halls. We're putting it to the parties and the party leaders. There's no mixing words here. We're telling them this. We're not asking anymore. This is our demands. This is what has to be done.
As I mentioned earlier, this is an election year. We're a few months out from the election. Going forward, what else could we see coming from BC Wildlife Federation in this region? And also, what other forums? I asked earlier about having an all-candidates debate about some of these issues. What's been the plans for the next few months?
We're hoping to do an all-candidates debate. Like I just mentioned, we need some candidates. We need a platform to discuss. We're willing to stand up and have a discussion with our MLAs, our party leaders, our ministers. We have no issue being available at any time, anywhere. We try to meet with some of our MLAs. They will not meet with us within this region, within these towns. They don't want to talk to us right now. And there's an election coming. People better be willing to talk to us because we're not going to go away. We're going to be here to discuss what's wrong. We're going to be here to tell you to demand what we want. We're going to educate the people. Once we get the platforms, we'll take them apart. We'll take a look at them and see what sounds good. We're going to hold these people accountable. We know we've heard it before. They've talked about it in the past. We're going to promise. Promises aren't acceptable. Put it in writing. This is not an ask. It's a demand. Put it in writing that this is what you will deliver if elected.
Okay, fellas, we'll leave it there, but much obliged to answering my questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook at CICK News. CICK News is made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to our producer Pam Hassan and all of our roving reporters, I'm Dan Messick. Thanks for listening.
This is a CKTZ News Update. I'm Lonnie Taylor. The Cortez Housing Society has faced another blow, being rejected for the third time in an application process to receive grants from BC Housing towards their Rainbow Ridge Affordable Housing Project. The BC Housing Fund is called the Community Housing Fund, and it is the same fund that the Cortez Housing Society has applied for previously, which includes capital for construction loan, a future low interest rate for long-term mortgage, with a large BC Housing grant, plus an annual operating grant from BC Housing to help keep rental rates affordable. If Cortez is selected for this stream of funding, then the Cortez Housing Society would be offering a mix of 20% deeply subsidized units plus 50% rent geared to income, RDI units, plus 30% market rental units. The total budget for the housing project includes site infrastructure, road, driveways, parking, power, waste, water, landscaping, and stormwater systems, plus building 24 townhomes. And that budget is a total of $16 million. The 55-acre parcel for the project was acquired back in 2018. And originally, it was hoped that by 2020, they'd be breaking ground and starting construction on a 24-unit development of affordable housing. 6 years later, the Housing Society has been rejected after a third round of applications to BC Housing for funding the affordable housing. The Cortez Community Housing Society also noted that they received $100,000 from BC Housing to continue the progress of their project, and that was and they were notified on that at the beginning of April. CKTZ reached out to a media contact with BC Housing. Laura McLeod responded with the following statement. We recognize that there is an urgent need to create more options for people who are struggling to find reasonably priced rental homes that meet their needs. That's why through the Building BC Community Housing Fund, we are creating thousands of new subsidized homes that growing families, individuals, seniors, people living with disabilities, and Indigenous peoples can afford. In March 2024, BC Housing announced the third round of CHF funding recipients. There was an overwhelming number of proposals received for the most recent Community Housing Fund request for proposals, including many well put together and worthwhile submissions, such as from the Cortez Community Housing Society. We are funding more than 40 projects that will provide approximately 3,500 affordable rental homes for people in BC. On Vancouver Island, 8 projects have been selected to move forward, totaling in 867 new units. There is considerable interest in CHF funding, and unfortunately, Cortez Community Housing Society's proposal for Rainbow Ridge, 24 units of housing located at 965 Beasley Road, was not one of the projects selected for funding this round. BC Housing conducted an independent review and scoring procedure to ensure CHF funding decisions were made in a consistent and transparent manner. The Cortez Community Housing Society's submission, although strong, did not rank high enough in the CHF scoring procedure. Cortez Housing Society will be attending a debrief with BC Housing staff later this month to learn more about what aspects of their proposal could be improved so their application is better positioned for success. We anticipate the next call for CHF funding to take place in late 2024 or early 2025, and we encourage the society to apply. BC Housing continued in their statement, in addition, the society is eligible for BC Housing Provincial Development Fund, PDF. The PDF provides financing for eligible groups who have an affordable housing proposal but need additional financial support to advance their project to prepare a more fully formed and competitive proposal, including the necessary due diligence, feasibility analysis, and design specifications. Those eligible for PDF loan can access up to $250,000 in support. We expect to be able to share more details about this application soon. The approximately 3,500 recently announced CHF homes are part of a $19 billion housing investment by the BC government. This is the largest housing investment in British Columbia's history. Since 2017, the province has nearly 78,000 homes that have been delivered or are underway. In addition, the Strathcona Regional District has also awarded $140,000 from the Community Works Fund, which is a gas tax fund, and that will go towards the development of a public road access for the housing development. At the recent SRD meeting on April 24th, Regional Director Mark Von Esch explained the importance of continuing the project's development and awarding the $140,000 from the SRD for the building of the access road. Director Von Esch commented,
just wanted to add that this is funds from Cortez gas tax funding, and that this is a real need in our community is to get this nonprofit housing built. And this is another small step forward in getting that done. And it fits under the mandate of what the funding is. There's a big need in the community, and I hope we'll find support around the board table for this. Thank you.
And the Chief Administrative Officer discussed the qualifying aspects of the funding.
This request from the gas tax does fit. It's a public access road, so even though it is accessing what is potentially going to be, it is going to be a public housing project, the access road is open to the public, so it's eligible for gas tax.
Director Von Esch.
I'd like to move that an agreement be prepared to authorize up to $140,000 of the Area B Community Works funds being allocated to construct road access to the Rainbow Ridge Housing Project under contract with the Cortez Housing Society.
Since the third round of BC Housing grants was rejected, there will be two more housing forums with panelists to discuss other options in developing the land without the grants. On Saturday, May 18th, there will be three presentations on creative initiatives followed by questions, as well as breakout discussions about how ideas could relate to housing on Cortez. The panelists featured at the event will be John Davis from the Center for Community Land Trust Innovation, Lisa Byers from Opal Community Land Trust, and Sandy Bishop from Lopez Community Land Trust. This is an online Zoom presentation, and it's encouraged by the Housing Society that if you have any proposals for alternative, innovative, affordable housing, to send them to Sadu Afox-Johnson, the executive director for the Cortez Housing Society. For years now, one of the alternatives discussed has been to put in a tiny home project, and Sadu has continued to float this concept, though it has been explored in previous years and in a previous update with Greg Asoba of CKTZ News on the hoops that need to be jumped in order to establish such a tiny home community on community land.
Lonnie Taylor, CKTZ News, Cortez Island. CKTZ News is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, the program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Central Kootenay Area's F, H, and J decisively voted no to curbside collection services in their communities. Areas F and H saw 1,023 people voting no and 131 voting yes. Area J had a similar result with 830 votes no to 103 votes yes. The RDCK's chief elections officer, Tom Duell, was impressed with the high voter turnout.
We got a great turnout. We got over 30% for the assent vote for areas E and F, and then over 39% for the vote find area J, which is like a great turnout that exceeds a lot of elections.
Area J communities, the surrounding city of Kalskar on the banks of the Columbia River and Lower Arrow Lake, currently receive recycling collection services that the RDCK is not involved in. Waste and organics are disposed of by residents. Area F, the north shore of the Kootenay River, and Area H, the Silicon Valley, do not receive any collection services. The RDCK was offering three stream services, waste, recycling, and organics, in all communities. Matt Morrison, the organics coordinator, said there were several concerns residents had that caused them to vote no.
Common concerns would be logistics. People had concerns around the cost. For a lot of people, $280 a year was too much. People had concerns around wildlife and felt like the green bin program would cause more wildlife conflict in the communities.
Reporting in Nelson, Scott Onstreck, KCR News.
And Davaloan, I'm Sabrina Spencer with The Journey Continues, highlighting local stories that matter to you. The Kitimat Museum Archives held their exhibit opening reception on Friday evening for Haisla Artists, an Indigenous art exhibition. CFNR was on location for the opening, later talked with Catherine Johnson, a board chair for the museum, and Louise Avery, the executive director.
Catherine Johnson, and I am the board chair for the Kitimat Museum.
Okay, so today you just had your opening for your exhibit. Can you tell me a little bit about the exhibit?
After the food is done, we're all going to go over to the museum, and the gallery is going to be opened up at that time. So this is Haisla Artist exhibit exclusively. And it's a first. And I don't know if you were here when I spoke about having a dream come true. And that's what this is, because it's all about bringing Haisla connection to Kitimat connection and bringing this richness of the artists in the community into the museum to share with the whole wide world, right? So it's pretty exciting stuff. So I feel shaky inside. The door has been opened and that we can do this again, and it's going to become a community gathering connection and a unification and a togetherness and a sense of belonging for everybody. When the connection to even building that whole idea, that whole concept that for the Haisla Nation and other First Nations people.
And then what do you feel is the importance of having something like this for the Haisla people to get their artwork and show their culture?
I think it is a shout out loud to say, look at what we do, look what we can do, and look at this beautiful richness that our community's ready for. We need to see it, we need to share it. And do you know that there's, I almost hate to say this, but there's people in this community that have never visited the Kitimat Village. And it's the bridge. All my teaching career has been about, let's build a bridge. This is about building a bridge too, and bringing us together. And as far as for individuals, man, it's time, because there are some very talented people.
Louise Avery, and I'm the executive director at the Kitimat Museum and Archives.
Can you tell me how many artists you're featuring in your exhibit?
There are 26.
Okay. And about what is the age range of your artists?
Sam Robinson, he's turning 90, and he's the oldest. He's got a couple of carvings. And the youngest, I believe, is Troy Windsor, and he made puppets. So what we did was we really opened up the whatever creative work the person was doing, we welcomed them in. So it's a real community exhibit of art. It includes both Haisla, traditional farm line, but also there's a variety and diversity of media.
Nice. And then how long did it take for this to come together?
Gosh, we've been planning it for months. I think January we started, even before, we started getting the word out in November, December. And so it's taken a number of months. At first I had to go and get funding as well from different funders. So there's four different main funders, the District of Kitimat and LNG Canada and JGC Floor, and the fourth one is Pinto. And then also Kitimat Community Foundation put money in as well. So those are all our main funders, so that we could create an exhibition booklet. And then also we're paying an artist fee to each artist. So they, if you go on Canadian, is it like a standard site? It's called Carfac, and it shows group shows and how much each artist should be paid. It's a standard in Canada to pay artists that fee. So we pay them to participate in the show. So each one of them will be compensated, receive a sum of money.
The dates and stuff, you're opening tonight, obviously.
Yeah, so, and then we're on till July 13th. And we did a soft opening on the 8th. We actually had Minerals North, a busload of people came in to see the show on the 8th, which was very nice for some of the delegates to come in and see it. And we've been really wanting to get that great information from different artists, why they started, what they're doing with their art, or the challenges and what they prefer to do, and just their expressiveness. So we try to get into the artistry and what the artist is trying to do. And some are very traditional, and some are very contemporary, and some are like a fusion of both. So that's what I found too. And we have some artists that have participated in Frida Deesing. They've taken coursework there, and I think it's really a lovely show. We even have like Arthur Renwick, he performs, or Orson Welles, he's been performing for a long time, and at Wee Geordie's, and he's also got his songs upstairs. We've brought it in on an iPad and hooked it up to YouTube so that we can, he can play his music. And then there's another fellow, Jeremiah, he does rap music, and then he does creative, what is it, like a video. He's created computer generated art, and it's really quite lovely with his rap music. So.
This story is brought to you in partnership with the Local Journalism Initiative of Canada. You can see the full story at frequencynews.ca.
And that's this week's episode of The Scoop, a podcast and broadcast featuring stories from remote BC by the journalists in the communities of Smithers, Cortez Island, Revelstoke, Kootenay, Prince George, and Terrace. This program was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program. Tune in next week for another episode and follow us online wherever you get your podcasts.